NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
6 minutes past 1 o'clock. This is WILL Urbana. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a tornado watch for portions of northern and central Illinois, effective until 5 p.m. this afternoon. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the tornado watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Champaign, Ford, Vermilion, DeWitt, and Piatt. Repeating, a tornado watch in effect for portions of northern and central Illinois until 5 o'clock this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. In the program today, we're going to take a look at the story of the Pullman Porter. Journalist Larry Tai says, if race is the story of America, the Pullman Porter represents one of its most resonant chapters. Larry Tai has written a history of Pullman Porters, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters, and the Making of the Black Middle Class. Tai's book takes readers over the course of 100 years of American history from the end of the Civil War until the end of the 1960s when the Pullman Company terminated its sleeping car service. Tai says the most influential black man in America for those 100 years was the Pullman Porter. This afternoon we'll talk about the roles Pullman Porters played in labor and civil rights and more. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. You can join us on the telephone with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Larry Tai was a longtime reporter for the Boston Globe, where he won many awards for his work. He is now the director of a training program for medical journalists. He is a former Nieman Fellow at Harvard. In addition to Rising from the Rails, Tai is the author of The Father of Spin and Homelands. His new book, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters, and the Making of the Black Middle Class, is published by Henry Holt. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Larry Tai, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Great to be with you today.
You came to this story during your fellowship at Harvard when a professor spoke of the Pullman Porters as a way to understand American history and culture. You were hooked on the story from the outset, weren't you?
I was. He described it as the all-American story, trying to understand how these porters rose from ex-slaves to becoming what he and I thought was the fathers of today's black middle class. And the idea of that kind of dramatic rise, also the idea of being able to look within the closed capsule of a railroad car at 100 years of race history in America, was too tempting for me as a journalist not to take a deeper look at it.
Yeah. You say when you met to interview the porters and other black railroad workers, they thought you'd dropped from another planet, but ultimately they wanted you to tell this story. Would you tell us about some of the Pullman Porters you met in the course of researching this history?
I would, and I'd like to particularly focus on some of the Pullman Porters I met in Chicago, where there are more of them alive today and more interesting stories than just about anywhere in America. And what happened was I'd show up on their doorstep, having called them beforehand to set up an interview, and these are guys who, at their youngest, were in their late 80s, and the oldest of them was when I interviewed this porter in Chicago. He was 102. He's now 104. I'd show up on their doorstep, ring their bell, and they would look at me and think, I didn't know you were white. And I had the sense that for the first 15 minutes of every interview that they were wary about me. What is this guy from Boston, a white reporter from Boston, here trying to tell our story? After 15 minutes, I could have been green and from the planet Mars. And the idea was that I was a guy who was there. I was interested enough in them to have come all that way. And they knew that it was essential before they die to tell their story so their kids and grandkids would have a sense of what their role was on the railroads. And so I happened to be the guy who was there and telling it. And it started off by my being some strange presence on their doorstep. It ended up 2 or 3 or 4 hours later with their being willing to talk as long as I wanted them to.
Mm-hmm. And what's the response been among the children and grandchildren of these men?
The response to the book, mm-hmm. in terms of the people that I've talked to so far, has been two different kinds of responses, both of which were very rewarding to me. One was the sense of thank you for telling a story about my father or grandfather, uncle, whoever the relative was, that they didn't know. And they didn't know the story because these men had absorbed such humiliation and abuse as part of their life on the rails. Those are the kinds of things you don't want to go home and tell your wife or tell your kids. And so many of these children, and even more so the grandchildren, never really understood. They understood some of the wonderful things about getting to see the country and the good stories, but they never understood some of the difficulties that the porters had encountered. The other response was, thank you also for giving me a sense of where I got certain kinds of values. We all grow up with a certain sense of the important things in the world, but we're not always sure. We can't often pinpoint where they came from. And these descendants of porters, after they have looked at the book, say that they now understand the context better for what the inheritance that they got was and just the significance of that.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit to me like interviewing for a previous book, Holocaust survivors, who often it was only when they were on their deathbeds that they would feel comfortable about sharing the horrors of what had happened in their lives to even their children and grandchildren. And these Pullman porters have been the same way. And I'm just glad I got to so many of them at a time when they're getting really old and may not be around for long.
Yeah. These men, you write, fueled black advancement, but that advancement came at a huge price. A couple of questions here, and maybe you give us kind of an overview of where we're headed over the next half hour or so. How important was the Pullman porter in terms of the advancement of African Americans? And would you talk in general about what the Pullman porters endured on the job?
Sure. In terms of their importance, I call them in the preface to my book possibly the most important black men in the last 100 years of American history, and that is not really hyperbole. If I were to start naming names for you of people who worked on the trains or were the sons and daughters of people who worked on the trains, people like Thurgood Marshall, the Supreme Court Justice, who was a train porter and whose dad was a train porter, mayors of San Francisco and L.A. like Willie Brown and Tom Bradley, great jazz musicians like Oscar Peterson, and one after the other in terms of everything from scientists and doctors, lawyers, and political figures, these sons and daughters of porters made enough of an impact on America and particularly on African America that I think to call them the most important black man in America is really not an exaggeration. They did extraordinary things. Your other question was asking about the abuse that they endured.
Mm-hmm.
They endured abuse that ranged from being called names, and the name that they most hated was they were called George. And they were called George because of an insidious tradition that was passed down from the days of slavery, where slaves were named after their slave masters. And in the case of the porter, it was presumed that they were the slaves of George Pullman, the man who started this sleeping car service. And porters were called all kinds of names. They were forced to do demeaning work, and the kind of work that they did didn't bother them. It was when passengers showed no respect for them as being human beings, as being men of dignity. And there was a sense, this was in a way the kind of setup that George Pullman had intended from the start. He understood that if he hired ex-slaves, and especially dark-skinned ex-slaves, that there would be this sense of social separation between his passengers and his servants that would ensure that the passengers would feel totally comfortable. Whatever embarrassing things they did on the train, from getting drunk to ending up in the berth of somebody who wasn't their spouse, that they'd never run into these porters who inhabited a different planet. They'd never run into them off the train. And so there was almost a built-in sense of separation that made it easier for racism and for other real mean things to happen on the train.
Yeah. There was also there's this strange intimacy that is allowed while the train is moving that ends when the train comes into the station.
you're right, and that's the other half of the picture, what went on the train. On one half was the humiliation, the other half was an intimacy, that while in a normal situation, if many of the white passengers, the wealthy, influential whites who were riding in the Pullman cars, ran into a man who was a Pullman porter on the street, they might walk to the other side of the street, and they would certainly have no social interaction with these men. On the Pullman train, they were turning their children over to these men to take care of them cross-country. They were telling them, confiding in them with things, because they were the only guys around to confide in. There was this wonderful sense of communication and intimacy that was the flip side of the humiliation and abuse, and neither were really what happened in the world outside of this car. And so this intimacy ended up translating, in something we can talk about later, into a sense of these black porters picking up, watching and listening and picking up critical lessons about how the successful white world worked that they ended up translating into their own lives.
Mm. Another way that Pullman porters made a contribution to American history was they played quite a role in the Great Migration, something I'd never thought of before.
A wonderful role in the Great Migration, which, as your listeners and you know, was a migration of millions of blacks from the South, often from the rural South, to northern cities and especially to Chicago in the early 1900s. And the porters played a role in that in a number of ways. One is they delivered newspapers, particularly newspapers like the Chicago Defender, black newspapers, to the South. These newspapers described in alluring detail how much better life was for blacks in the North than in the South. But it wasn't just that they were taking this written word of it. The porters were a human embodiment of this better life. They were dressed in elegant blue uniforms. They had money in their pocket. They carried themselves with dignity. And they generally lived in the big railroad cities of the North, in Chicago and Los Angeles and New York and Boston. And the fact that they had this good life and that they were traveling through these small towns in the South was physical evidence for the people who were living there of just how good things must be up north of the Mason-Dixon line. And so they helped carry this word and fuel the migration.
Yeah. You write in the book at one point, the flight, if the migration was, as historians say, the flight from Egypt, then the Pullman porter was Moses.
That's absolutely true. And there's a wonderful collection of all of these stories and papers in the heart of Chicago at the Newberry Library, which has all the Pullman Company's papers assembled there. They've done a wonderful job of organizing them, and all of this is there in incredibly vivid detail, telling the story of this migration north, telling the story of the Pullman as Moses, and it is not just an all-American story, but more than anything, it's an all-Chicago or all-Illinois story, because so much of what happened in this railroad world happened in the crossroads of America, which was Chicago.
Yeah. You know, I know the Pullman porter from old movies and television shows, and the picture painted was not flattering. How have these men been portrayed in popular culture?
They've been portrayed at best as sort of backdrops, almost the staging in the background. You want to evoke the elegance of that era of rail travel, and what better thing than having a white-coated black Pullman porter in the background of the train. And the train itself conjures up mystery and adventure. You've got these porters conjuring up the image of elegance. And the sad thing is that they also are generally in a very stereotyped role in terms of what you see in movies and in books and anywhere in popular culture. It's the stereotype of them sort of having one-word, heavily accented answers. And I found almost no movies or books that truly captured them as rich, deep human beings, and that was because most of the filmmakers and most of the authors had only interacted with porters as passengers and never really had taken the trouble to get to know them as humans.
Yeah, the role they play in these movies and television shows and books and whatnot was that of George.
Absolutely that of George, the stereotype George.
Yeah. Well, the story begins with George Pullman. Born 1830, died 1897. What should we know about him?
What you should know about him relative to this story is that he was an exceedingly smart, savvy entrepreneur, and he understood a year after the Civil War, when he was starting his railroads, his sleeping car service, He understood that one critical thing was to have the most elegant car as you could and make it comfortable for people to lie down, get some sleep as they were doing these long-distance trips across America. But he understood for passengers to be willing to pay more than twice the normal train ticket price for his sleeping cars, he had to give them service. That service was what they were going to remember even more than the elegance of his accommodations. And he hit on a brilliant idea, which was, who better to be the perfect, unquestioning servant than an ex-slave who had back then no choices other than going back to work in the fields as a sharecropper or taking a menial job in a factory. He was offering them the chance to wear a great uniform, to do work that wasn't nearly as backbreaking, and most important of all, to see America. That was what he was giving them. What they gave him was quite extraordinary in terms of giving them people who were willing to work for very little money, people who would work as long hours as he wanted, up to 400 hours a month, and most important of all, the thing that we talked about a few minutes ago, this sense of social separation, a sense that they would be these invisible figures in the background, there to do whatever a passenger wanted, but never there to present a threat in terms of watching everything from women undress to the most intimate interactions during 3 or 4 days on a trip across country. He had his perfect servant.
And the Pullman Company, within a few short years, became the largest employer of black men in the U.S., you say perhaps the world.
That's true. By the early 1900s, definitely the largest employer in the U.S. and probably the world. And that was the upside. The downside was that he was exploiting these guys. The upside was that he was at the same time giving them a huge opportunity to do all this travel, to eventually earn decent money. But he also was really smart and tactical in terms of what he paid them. He paid them very little money for two reasons. One is because he didn't want to pay them a lot and he wanted to earn bigger profits. But the other was he understood if they depended on something beyond their salary to support their families, that they would depend on tips. And depending on tips meant being willing to do anything that a passenger asked him during a trip across country to ensure a tip. So you want to ensure the perfect servant who's going to be obliging to anything a passenger asks for, you make them dependent on a tip for their livelihood.
Mm-hmm. Obliging and invisible.
Absolutely. Those are two key words.
What was required of a successful applicant?
A successful applicant had to have a record that showed no brushes with the law. They had to have enough money to go out and buy the uniform that was required for the train. And the ultimate, and to me the ultimate in offensiveness, but something that came out clearly through the records at the Newbury and other records that I explored, was that George Pullman put a premium on dark-skinned blacks. And that dark skin was just part of this emphasizing the distinction between patron and servant. And he figured, as one Pullman porter phrased it, he wanted the darkest skins with the whitest smiles.
Hmm. Maybe you could expand on that idea in terms of the ex-slaves and the early employees of Pullman, the men he hired. Some left accounts of their experiences. How did they speak of the job of porter?
They spoke of it. Every porter that I've ever talked to generally wants to focus on the upside of the job. They talked about it being a way to travel. They talked about forming these incredible bonds to the point of even developing their own language that let them speak without passengers being able to understand what they were doing. They talk about a camaraderie and an adventure on the road, and that's partly that the older you get, the more you want to remember the good things about what went on. But with every one of them, as I started to probe what some of the humiliations that they had to absorb were, they all talked about them, whether it was being called names, whether it was being physically pushed, or there were little and big humiliations that were a critical part of their experience on the road. And you can't see the upside without seeing the down. You can't see the down without being the up. And that's what the porter's experience was all about. It was these two contradictory sides that they had to somehow learn to live with. And it was good enough for most of them that most of them stayed. Not only did they stay for an entire career, but many of them passed the jobs on to sons and grandsons.
Hmm. What did a porter earn in wages and tips?
They earned when you added wages and tips together, they were clearly, for most of the late 1800s and the early 1900s, they were among the better paid of any black workers, certainly of black blue-collar workers. The wonderful expression in the black world in the late 1800s and throughout the 1900s was the two best jobs open to black men were Pullman and postal, meaning working for the post office where you got a nice uniform, you had a clean job, and you earned a decent living, or going on the train. The train, again, had the one big advantage. The guys who were working the post office had to stay local. The guys who were working the trains got to see America and came back with brilliant stories.
Mm. 400 hours a month.
Imagine that.
I was absolutely floored. 1888, the goal of the company had been that the porters would get 5 hours of rest a day, a night. But in 1929, that goal goes down to 3 hours and less.
It is. Imagine you and I as journalists work, if we think we're working a lot, if we work 50 or 60 hours, imagine 100 hours a week on 3 or 4 hours sleep. And even those 3 or 4 hours were never guaranteed. They were sleeping in the smoking compartments, which doubled as a men's bathroom. They were sleeping behind a very thin curtain on a worn-out couch. So, A, assuming that you could actually sleep on that couch, it also presumes that people weren't coming into the bathroom the way they did all night to have a cigarette, to have a talk, or to use the facilities. The chance of their even getting an uninterrupted 3 or 4 hours sleep was really minimal, and they could be out on the road for a week at a time. And I don't quite understand. I thought that in what we do, we're supposed to sort of get by with crazy deadlines and long hours. I can't even begin to imagine how they functioned.
Yeah. What was a day in the life of a Pullman porter like?
A day in the life of a porter meant getting up after your 3 or 4 hours sleep for the rest of the night. You were on duty, sort of making sure that everything was okay in your car. You were shining shoes and often shining, you know, 30 pairs of shoes a night. There are wonderful pictures that we have in the book of porters shining these shoes and sort of describing what life was like hour by hour in terms of these kinds of activities. It meant during the day you were doing everything from bringing food to their compartment to acting as nursemaid for the kids to sewing up if their clothing was torn or they needed it pressed. You were the ones who did that. You were making up 20 or 30 beds a day. You were doing everything that a hotel would have a maid, a chambermaid, a janitor, a bellman. You were every kind of servant in a hotel, only you were in a hotel on wheels, and you were doing it for 20 hours a day.
Yeah. There's an ad that you've reproduced in the book. How many individuals does it take to make a Pullman car work, or what is that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about, and that's basically an ad sort of featuring, it's a way of their highlighting just who the critical people are in terms of providing the service on the train, and it goes through, the title of the ad is How Many People Make a Good Night's Sleep. It goes through and shows you everything from the person who is doing the engineering and maintenance on the car to maids who are in Pullman laundries pressing your towels and sheets. But it's not accidental that at the centerpiece of this ad and of every ad the Pullman Company ran over the years is the Pullman Porter. It was them more than anything that distinguished Pullman service from any other kind of service you'd get anywhere. Pullman tended to become a shorthand for going first class, and the embodiment, the symbol of that first-class service was the Pullman Porter.
Yeah, he's the number one man in this ad, How Many People Make a Good Night's Sleep. And four of these six individuals are African-American.
That's true. And the only one, though, who's visible in terms of the passenger is the black porter. The others are people who work in laundries and other facilities off-site. And often the facilities there, just outside of Chicago in what was at one point the independent town of Pullman, Illinois. And the extraordinary thing with the porters was that they were the one black worker that George Pullman actually allowed to interact in a personal way with his passengers, only he was leaving absolutely nothing to chance. He had an extraordinary rule book that spelled out precisely everything these porters were to do, how to fold a sheet, mm-hmm. how to... He told them no teeth marks or chin creases were allowed on on pillowcases. He told them precisely how to drape a curtain across a berth. Ladies, he told them, got two curtains. Everything was precisely spelled out in a rule book that had something like 200 specific rules. And if you violated any of those rules as a Pullman porter, you were subject to dismissal.
One of the things we're likely to think about when we hear George Pullman's name today was the community he built near Chicago, Pullman, Illinois. It was built on a brilliant vision, you say, but like the Tower of Babel, it was built on so many contradictions it had to crumble. Talk with us, if you will, about Pullman, Illinois. What was it like, and what would you like to say about its downfall?
What it was like, I did a walkthrough with people from the Pullman Foundation out there and got a wonderful sense of how the buildings here today might have looked by looking at pictures, but also looking at their vision as they walked me through the town. And it was the ultimate in planned American communities. It was supposed to have, it did have everything from a theater to a library to stores for the employees. It was no liquor allowed for the employees. It was seen as taking these European craftsmen and some Americans who had come in to be the workers on George Pullman's factories and giving them every physical need, every social need that George Pullman could envision for them, taking care of it right there in one town, the perfect planned industrial community. The problem with it was that, A, he allowed them no democracy. B, it was okay for he and his friends to drink liquor at the Florence Hotel, which was in the middle of Pullman, but not for his workers to drink there or anywhere else. He had this sense of sanitization, of authoritarian rule, and what ended up being the biggest downfall was that even during the recession of the late 1800s and 1890s, when there was a serious recession and he had to cut his wages, he kept his rent stable or raised them, and he didn't understand that workers needed more than anything to earn a decent enough living that they didn't have to worry about survival. He also banned from his town. There's a couple exceptions, people think, but he basically banned blacks from living in his town. So the porters were good enough to go in his sleeping cars, but not to live in the town named after him. And the ultimate downfall of the town came after the Pullman strike in the late 1800s, when workers staged a strike that became violent as it was crushed, and George Pullman fired many of the workers, and it was a sign of just how anti-union he was, and that became apparent later with the Pullman porters.
Yeah, big part of the story. The strikers came out on the losing end, and I suppose it might be fair to say that was due in part to the fact that the Pullman porters were not asked to join the strike.
Yes, afterwards, the guy who led the railroad strike was Eugene Debs, and afterwards he regretted, and it was unclear if he was just trying to sort of clear up a blemish on his record or if he meant it, but he regretted that he didn't bring the porters in as part of the strike, and they were critical enough to the operation of the sleeping cars that it might have done them, the strikers, a lot of good. On the other hand, it might have done the porters a lot of harm, and a lot of them probably would have lost their jobs in what might still have been an unsuccessful strike.
Mm-hmm. Larry Tye is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's written a history of Pullman porters, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. They're invited. I look forward to hearing from you. Here are the numbers. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, at this point, late 1890s, at this point, what's the situation with unions and the railroads?
Sure. The situation at that point is that unions generally don't especially aren't welcome on the railroads. They are particularly unwelcome at George Pullman's company. He died with one of his most lasting legacies was as a huge strike breaker. And it was at this time that the Pullman porters made their earliest efforts to try to organize themselves. They began in the late 1890s. They got really serious in terms of their campaign to form a union in 1925, but it took a full 12 years for them to actually succeed in winning a union. And it was a shocking development when they won it. They were the first really successful black trade union in America, and they had stood toe-to-toe with one of the most powerful and most anti-union companies in America, and they had prevailed. And they had prevailed not just despite the efforts of George Pullman, but his successor as president of the Pullman Company was the great liberator's son, was Abe Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln. And Lincoln was every bit as anti-union as his predecessor George Pullman had been. And in fact, the porters had an expression about that. They said, Abe Lincoln freed the slaves, and his son Robert Todd re-enslaved them. And it was a really, it was only slightly an exaggeration. He really was a tough guy with his Pullman porters.
Yeah, boy, that's a less than flattering portrait, is putting it mildly, of Robert Todd Lincoln.
It is true.
Here in this story. And also what is amazing to me is the tactics of the company to keep the unions down, to keep the Pullman porters down. At every corner, they were out to co-opt them.
That's true. They were out to co-opt them. They were out to stop them through anything they had to do. And that meant for hundreds of porters losing their jobs. Again, those Newbury Library papers really tell quite explicitly what was going on in terms of porters being fired. There was also evidence that porters, some of the leaders of the porters union, were beat up. Any tactic that they could use, from coercion to enticing them by trying to start a house union, an in-house union that the porters could belong to, but that the Pullman Company would really control, that was one other way that they tried to co-opt them. My favorite stories about co-option, and they're particularly Chicago stories, are the way the Pullman Company seeded money that it was giving out into black churches, into a YMCA that served the black community, to try to get these critical entities in the community, these very powerful social institutions like the churches, like the YMCA and other social clubs, to be on the side of the Pullman Company and against the union, and it worked. They had many ministers preaching for their congregants not to support this crazy strike by the Pullman porters and the crazy organizing activities, and it worked for a while, and it was part of the sense of being beaten down everywhere they turned by these porters. Thankfully, they had the stick-to-itiveness, and thankfully they had a leader who was as amazing a leader as A. Philip Randolph.
Yeah.
To take them through in this 12-year struggle.
Yeah. We're going to talk about A. Philip Randolph in a moment here. Let's first talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Indiana, Line 4. Go ahead.
Hello. I don't want to say too much because I'm more interested in listening to the story about Randall than on my question, but my question's simple. Per Pullman car, how many porters did you have normally?
Listen
to the Randall thing. That needs a book.
Sure, it does need a book, and actually somebody there is working on a book on it. And the but per car, you generally had a porter assigned to a car, but they would do backup for one another at night and other times when they needed more help. But they had something like, it varied, but something like 20 beds that each of them were assigned to. And that was not easy. That meant 20 pairs of shoes to be shined at night, 20 passengers with sort of crazy demands, and it was perpetual work. That's why it took 20 hours a day to keep up with things.
Hmm. Very good. I want to thank the listener for his call. Philip Randolph, Asa Philip Randolph. Very interesting character, pivotal character in this story. What should we know about him?
Sure. What we should know about him is that he was not a Pullman porter, and that was a strategic decision, turning to a man who wasn't a porter to lead this union of porters. It was strategic because the porters realized that if it was a porter who was leading their effort, that that would be easy for somebody at the Pullman Company to target and fire. So they went to an outsider, a young guy who came to New York from Jacksonville, Florida, who had grown up all his life with segregation and abuse, but who had really been toughened. He was a socialist. He was an activist. He had tried unsuccessfully to launch several other unions, and this was sort of his last shot in a big way at showing that he could be a successful organizer. It was the porters they felt last shot at showing that they could organize the Pullman Company. It was the perfect man finding the perfect job, and he stuck with it for 12 years to found the union. He also went on to become what I think was one of the most effective leaders of the civil rights movement. I say that if Martin Luther King Jr. was the father of civil rights in America, A. Philip Randolph was the grandfather.
Hmm. Now, you know, this union picture is interesting, I think, but it's something I want to talk about here. You know, the unions, going back to that strike of 1894, when the Pullman porters were not enlisted in the cause, those unions were white and quite antagonistic toward the black porters and other black railroad workers.
They sure were, and that was one other obstacle. I'm glad you pointed that out. In addition to having to fight the Pullman Company, they had to fight for years the AFL and the CIO and all the specifically railroad-related unions, which didn't want them, especially as members. They didn't want them. They didn't want to support their efforts. You would think that these were sort of brother unionists and that they would be encouraging of the efforts of the porters. Well, in fact, they were disdainful of them. And so it was on every turn that the porters seemed to be shunted. And it was only certain community groups in the black community, and particularly the wives of porters, who turned out to be extraordinary allies. When porters themselves could get in trouble for carrying any union literature or for doing anything else related to the unions, it was their wives who were doing this. And they were not only important in supporting the porters generally, but in the union efforts, they were absolutely critical.
Yeah. Well, A. Philip Randolph, he had to be careful. He also was quite fierce. How did he walk that line?
He did it the same way. Ironically, he was never a Pullman porter, but he could have taken his lesson from the porters who were perpetually walking that line between maintaining their dignity, and particularly in the community, and absorbing the humiliation they absorbed on the train. They all had to wear masks in a way that would let them smile to the passenger and sort of take and absorb the stuff inside without it eating away at them. Well, Randolph had to absorb all the abuse he was feeling from the company and from everybody else he was approaching for help, and just had to remain resolute. He had to know, which he did know, that it was only through a long, hard struggle that this was going to work, and he stuck with it long enough. He had great lieutenants, including Webster from Chicago, who was the head of the Chicago branch of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. But these are, by the way, if I could say that on this Saturday, at 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to be in Chicago at the Newberry Library, and we're going to be talking about these issues, specifically about Randolph. We will have great slides of the porters at work over the years, and anybody in your listenership is invited to come. The Newberry Library is on West Walton in the center of Chicago at 11 o'clock on Saturday, and all of these issues that are discussed in the book and that you're doing a wonderful job of raising here, we'll discuss at greater length on Saturday.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I have a piece of paper that's back outside the studio at my desk that I neglected to bring in here, because I was going to mention that opportunity to hear you speak and to take part in that forum. But thank you for mentioning that. So that's this week, at the end of the week here, on Saturday of this week.
Saturday at 11 a.m. And maybe more important than me, people might have had their fill of me, but we're going to have as many as possible of the surviving porters in the Chicago area come to be part of this discussion and tell their stories firsthand that I tried to tell in the book.
Yeah. And we're having our discussion this afternoon, Larry, on the 13th of July of 2004, because I know that I want to mention that, because I think this will be an interview that at some point in the future we will replay.
That's a very nice thought.
Okay, back to Philip Randolph and the Brotherhood of the Sleeping Car Porters. When did the organization come into being, and when did it win its first contract?
It came into being in 1925. It was almost 12 years to the day in 1937 that it won its first contract. And they were shocked, everybody on the porters' side of the table, the day the Pullman Company came in and said, "We'll sign." It took everybody by surprise. It was clear that it was a combination of the persistence of the porters, of the changing circumstances in America, and maybe most importantly, of FDR's New Deal legislation, that the Pullman Company finally saw that the writing was on the wall and that they were eventually going to have to accede to this, and they did. And instead of weakening their position in terms of the service that they were providing in this incredible sleeping car operation, that it strengthened it, because it gave the porters a sense of even greater pride in what they were doing. The money was increased and the hours were shortened, but it was still long hours, it was still small money, and the porters continued to provide for, until the late 60s, incredible service.
Yeah. You quote a porter who went to work for Pullman in 1937, Jewel Brown, saying, "The union took them off their knees."
Exactly. And it took them off their knees in several ways. And let me just tell you about one of them that I think is symbolic of what happened. I mentioned before that porters were called every name in the book, from the N-word to boy to, most disturbing of all to them, this notion that they were George Pullman slaves and that they were going to be referred to as George. One of the first things the union insisted on was that porters get name badges and that their name go up on the front of the car that they were responsible for and on their uniform and a little badge saying, "I am Jewel Brown," or whatever their name was. And this was really important to them. It was saying, "We are off our knees, we are real men, we have names, and call us by our name. Don't use these slurs with us." And that's what we'll respond to.
Yeah. What is the legacy of the Pullman porters today, looking back over this whole history, this chapter of American history?
Sure. There are, I think, three legacies. This is the political legacy, the sort of lasting legacy that history will look back at. The first legacy is the first successful black trade union in America, and it helped give confidence and give practical support to other unions. It helped make the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters an integral and equal part of the American Labor Union, of the AFL-CIO. So unions is number one. Number two is what they did in helping fuel the civil rights movement. They donated their union halls to civil rights causes. They helped bankroll, at a time when civil rights organizers didn't have money, the coffers of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Porters were opened up for civil rights activities, and most importantly, they offered the leadership to the civil rights movement. Everybody in your listenership knows certainly about the story of the Montgomery bus boycott, which we often look to as the birth of the civil rights movement. What I think people don't know is that when Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to move to the back of the bus, that the man she called down to the jail to bail her out was a Pullman porter named E.D. Nixon. And Nixon had been waiting for a long time to have a perfect test case for challenging the segregated bus system in Montgomery. He decided Parks was that case. The next day he called, as his third phone call, as he was trying to organize ministers, he calls a young minister named Martin King and says, "Will you come to a meeting the following day to talk about a boycott?" King says, "Let me think about it, get back to me." Nixon proceeds to call a total of 18 other ministers. He then calls back King and he says, "How about it? Will you come to our meeting?" And King says, "Okay, I'll come." And Nixon says, "Well, that's great, because these 18 ministers are coming to your church at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon." What Nixon did was, he was spending so much time out on the road that he couldn't personally oversee the bus boycott, so he turned to this bright young minister, King, to do it in his stead. This is what the porters did, A. Philip Randolph and others, throughout the civil rights era. They were the men behind the movement in really critical ways. So that's legacy number two, is civil rights. Most important legacy is what you and I started talking about 45 minutes ago, which is this legacy of having produced so many bright, talented sons and daughters that they formed the core of today's black middle class, the professional class, and that to me is the most lasting legacy. And when you talk to prominent African Americans in Chicago and other cities across America, it is astounding what percentage of them had a Pullman Porter descendant who wasn't just their descendant, who wasn't just their ancestor, but who had made a substantial difference in their lives. And that really is a legacy that will last the longest.
Hmm. On that, we will leave it. Good point to end. Again, would you tell us, Larry Tighe, about the event coming up this Saturday at the Newberry Library?
Sure. It's Saturday morning, 11 o'clock, the Newberry Library in West Walton in the center of town, and everybody's invited. There'll be me, there'll be a slideshow, and best of all, there'll be Pullman porters talking about their experience.
Very good. Thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon.
Thanks
for having me.
Larry Tighe has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He has written a history of Pullman porters rising from the rails, Pullman porters and the making of the black middle class. The book is published by Henry Holt. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit finished the day lower, especially in the nearby contracts, the July, August, and September all lower. November futures actually just up a bit for the day. From the grains floor, the wheat futures finished the day lower, as did the corn in the nearby July. The contract had a high today of 338 and a low at 332. Settlement price there at 333. They finished 0.75 cents lower. September wheat futures, the high 346, a low at 338.5, and settled at 339.5, down 0.75 cents for the day. And the December wheat, 360, the high, the low at 352. A settlement price there at 352.5, down 0.75 cents. And the nearby, or rather the March contract in the wheat pit now, 370, the high, the low at 363. Settled 363.25, down 0.75 cents. And the May contract, 374, the high, the low at 366. Settlement price at 366.5. They were down 6.5 on the day. From the corn pit for the day, 244.75, the high in the nearby July, the low at 240.75. Settled 241.75, down 2.75. And the September's 247.5, the high, the low at 244.25. Settled 244.75, down 3.25 for the day. December futures, 254.25, the high, the low at 251.25. Settled 251.75, down 2.5 cents for the day. The March contract, 262, the high, the low at 259.25. Settled 259.5, down 2.5 cents. And the May corn settled at 265. They were off 2.25 for the day, had a high of 267.25, the low there at 265. And that May corn contract, the same as settlement price. July futures, 271.25, the high, the low at 268.25, settled 268.5, down 0.25 cents for the day. July oats on the day, 136, the high, the low at 135.25, settled on the high at 136, unchanged. In the September's, 137.25, the high, the low at 135.25, settled 135.5, and they were down at 2.5 cents for the day. From the soy complex now, the nearby beans under pressure today, 925, the high, the low at 906, settled just above that low, 911, the settlement price, but the nearby July's, they were off 26 cents on the day. The August contract off 18.5 cents. 780 the high, the low at 762, settled 767.5. Once again, they were 18.5 lower. And the September futures, 664 the high there, low at 652.5, settled at 656.5, down 9.25 cents. November contract now, 649 the high, the low at 633, settled 641.25, up 0.25 cents. And the January beans, 651 the high, the low at 638, settled 645.5, and they finished the day 0.5 cents lower. And the final contract here, March futures, 653 the high, the low at 641, settled 650 in the bean pit, and they were unchanged on the day. Bean meal now, July contract, 306 the high, the low at 296, settled 301.30, down 1170 on the day. And the August contract, 270 the high, the low at 264.50, settled $266, even down 950. Bean oil futures, 27 the high, the low at 26.55, settled $26.90, they were down a dime on the day. And the August contract, 26.53, the high, the low at 26.15, settled at 26.42, and they were off 15 for the day. Hey, don't forget to visit with Dave Dickey and the crew tonight, along with our own chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser, in Arthur. Everything begins at 7 o'clock down there with an Outlook meeting. Be sure to join them. That's at the Community Center in Arthur this evening. And don't forget to stay with us this afternoon as we bring you the closing market report. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. Some interesting numbers yesterday out of USDA on the crop progress report. Dave and I were talking just before we came on the air, taking a look at the four top production states for corn. That'd be Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota. And the top three, Illinois, Iowa, and Nebraska, all well above 70% in the good to excellent category for the corn. And Illinois up at 87%. That's just a huge number. We'll talk about that with Wayne Nelson this afternoon. Now, here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. We will get to those numbers in just a moment. I do want to remind people that there is a tornado watch in effect for portions of northern and central Illinois until 5 o'clock this afternoon. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the tornado watch includes these counties in Illinois: Champaign, Ford, Vermilion, DeWitt, and Piatt. To the north of our severe weather coverage area, some pretty heavy weather at this hour. LaSalle, Lee, and Grundy counties bearing the brunt of some pretty heavy thunderstorms at this hour. Okay, now let's take a look at the numbers. August feeder cattle, 114 even the high, 113.20 the low, 113.52.5 the settlement, that down 2.5 cents. September, 112.10 the high, 111.25 the low, the settlement 112, that up 15. October feeder cattle, 109.20 the high, 108.20 the low, 109.10 the settlement, that up 20. July live cattle, 86.35 the high, 86.35, that is the number for the low in the settlement as well, down 55. August, 84.35 the high, 83.60 the low, 83.90 the settlement, that up 22.5. October, 86.97.5 the high, 86.20 the low, 86.75 the settlement, that up a nickel. July lean hogs, 79.45 the high, 78.70 the low, 78.95 the settlement, that down 50. August, 76.85 the high, 75.45 the low, 75.50 the settlement, that down 82.5. October lean hogs, 66.85 the high, 65.95 the low, 66.82.5 the settlement, unchanged. December, 62.02.5 the high, 61.40 the low, 62 even the settlement, that up 12.5. July bellies, 115.10 the high, 113.50 the low, 114.52.5 the settlement, that down 65. The Dow up 9 points at 10,247. The NASDAQ is down 3 at 1934. The S&P 500 up 1 at 1115.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, with 2004-2005 season musical performances by jazz greats Herbie Hancock, Michael Brecker, and Roy Hargrove, pianists Ivo Pugarelic and Richard Good, singers Nathan Gunn and Don Upshaw, and the Chicago and Prague Symphony Orchestras. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Stephen P. Statton from Bloomington, Minnesota writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why is the alphabet in that order?"
It's because of the song. Never underestimate the music industry's effect on the rest of us. Some Tin Pan Alley hack writes a catchy tune, and now every library in Western civilization has to organize all entries to the whims of that song. I know it doesn't make logical sense, but what does, especially when you're dealing with popular culture? I think the song's popularity comes from its sing-song nature, so understandable and easy to remember. Market it to kids and adults will follow. I mean, every fast food restaurant knows that, and now the librarians do too.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI.